Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that passionately abstains for what it believes in. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
And we also have, missing during our election coverage, but is now back from America, is Councillor Bridget Jones. Hello, Bridget.
Hello.
Now, usually in our podcasts, we like to take a step back and reflect, or we try and take a sideways look at what's going on. But in this episode, we're going to wade straight into the weeds. We're going to dive into the details and see what it means for the next few years in British politics. Stick around. In our last episode, we had no government, but now we do have a government.
Hooray!
Yay!
Which is exciting.
Life is so much better.
Nothing substantial has changed.
Nothing has changed.
I still believe in dinosaurs.
We've learned that the Conservatives really are not that good at negotiating.
I mean, there's a number of things which have revealed themselves over the past week or so. Number one, the way in which they've done a deal with the DUP. Number two is, as of today and a few days ago, a number of interesting little things have started to leak out about the Brexit talks between David Davis and Michel Barnier. Yeah, everything is not looking particularly rosy on the negotiating front for the Tories at the moment. David Davis's former chief of staff, James Chapman, journalist, I believe, for the Mail previously, has come out and basically been openly and actively briefing against Theresa May, directly saying that her positions on things like the European Court of Justice are directly damaging David Davis's ability to actually negotiate a Brexit deal. The fact that this somebody who is quite senior in the Tory government coming out and just openly saying this, that there are no anonymous sources or anything like this, this is an open briefing, suggests that there is a lot of discontent around Theresa May's style of negotiating and her absolutist, as it was described, stance on issues such as the ECJ.
The DUP wanted £2 billion for infrastructure spending in Ireland, and the Tories said, don't be ridiculous, have £1.5 billion instead.
So just £1.5 billion.
This bodes really well, doesn't it, for the Brexit negotiations?
Yeah, brilliantly. It's been suggested to us this week that maybe the Birmingham 9 Labour MPs should have banded together and formed their own deal with Theresa May to lever money for Birmingham. Sadly, I think their beliefs are too sensible to have entered into a deal with the Tory government.
That's the equivalent of a 10% jump in spending. Is Birmingham City Council going to get a 10% hike in spending?
If only we could, although that would barely cover one third of the cuts that we've had in the last few years. So that would be a drop in the ocean for us.
I mean, before we do get very smug, kind of drinking into our lattes, we maybe should remember
another avocado on toast.
Yeah, that's true.
Smashed.
In 2008, Gordon Brown wanted to pass 42 days without trial because he wanted to look tough on terror, because then the Daily Mail would love him. He reached out to the DUP. There were rumours anyway of an extra £200 million that was spent on infrastructure in Northern Ireland. The 9 DUP MPs voted for 42 days without trial, and the vote carried by 9 votes. Nick Clegg got on his high horse and said that this was pork barrel politics, and Sharmi Chakrabarti was saying something as well about how it was politics losing its way. And in fact, David Davis came out as well and said something which was slightly amusing. That was one vote, and you can see why the DUP would perhaps take a hard line on this anti-terror stuff that they have now. But when you're going to have so many different votes going through on Brexit, on budgets, on national security, I mean, what we can see from the votes after the Queen's speech, they're all going to be very close. They're all going to be basically 323 for and 309 against. And it is going to be because of those 10 DUP MPs. And how an austerity agenda can carry on with those DUP MPs propping the government up for money, I just don't see how it can carry on. I mean,
essentially, it can't, is the long and short of it, as far as I can see. I think it was Nick McPherson, who used to be like the most senior civil servant within the Treasury, on Twitter about a week or so ago, basically came out and said that when the deal with the DUP was first announced, that this wasn't just this was only the beginning. Given the nature of the hung parliament, given the fact that this wasn't a coalition, given the fact that Theresa May and the Tories are desperate to stay in power and are going and need the DUP's votes just to get anything through, they are going to be coming back time and time again, and they're going to be demanding more and more and more. The interesting thing with this, though, is how this then ends up relating to things like the Barnett formula and money that would otherwise go to places like Wales and Scotland. Currently, there's certainly, at the very least within the Welsh Liberal Democrats, and I think I've seen some things similarly from Welsh Labour, they've been making a big play of, hey, we're owed however many million pounds under the Barnett formula because of this extra spending. Same thing will also be the case in Scotland. And the more and more money gets spent in this way, the more and more difficult it becomes for the government to say this doesn't apply, or that the formula doesn't apply in this instance. Because if it becomes consistent, well, that's exactly what the formula's supposed to be, to deliver consistent funding across all of the devolved states. At which point, if someone decides to take the government to court over something like that, which I could easily see happening, it's the exact sort of thing if I were the SNP I'd be looking to do, could easily foresee a situation where, in effect, for the devolved states, austerity ends up ending very rapidly because this deal has gone through, which then leads in a really bizarre position where England isn't getting any more funding, but all of the other constituent nations are, which is very bad for the Tories.
The problem is she's shown that there is a magic money tree. Mm-hmm. It's just a question of when she wants to pick from it. But I'm going to be slightly controversial and say that the DUP were bought off pretty cheaply. £1 billion's not a ton of money. That's less than the annual Birmingham schools budget.
You're right in terms of the grand scheme of things. £1 billion isn't that much in terms of how much governments tend to spend. But £1 billion is it's a tangible amount in a lot of ways. It's when you deal with big numbers, people tend to zone out. Mm. When you're dealing with smaller amounts, granted, £1 billion's still a ton of cash, but it's a bit more conceivable.
Oh, it sounds like a lot.
Yeah.
But in real terms,
I think it's more that the DUP do not want Jeremy Corbyn to be Prime Minister. Surely the price for a DUP MP to vote for a Conservative government to keep Jeremy Corbyn out of number 10, which, let's face it, if the Queen's speech falls and there's a motion of no confidence in the government, it's very likely that there would be a Labour win and Corbyn would become Prime Minister. You'd have thought that would be threat enough, that you wouldn't then need to bung them another million or another billion or two.
Again, this is linking back to the notion of the Tories, or Theresa May in particular, being bad at negotiations. This is a classic example of that. They didn't need to make an announcement that says, we are going to form a government with the support of the DUP. All they needed to say was, we're going to form a minority government. Write the Queen's speech in whatever form it is. And once you've got that Queen's speech written, then you go up to the DUP and say, you're voting for this? Because otherwise, if this doesn't go through, Corbyn becomes Prime Minister.
Oh, well, that's not strong nor stable now, is it?
But it happens.
I mean, nor is what they've done, but you know, it's the stronger and stabler of the two options.
Yeah.
The interesting thing, I think, about that agreement is it's not Theresa May who signed it. It's Gavin Williamson who signed it, who's a Tory chief whip. That suggests to me that the Tories are very much open, and probably Theresa May herself, to be fair, is open on the is Theresa May toast question. I mean, she is toast. We just don't know when she's going to go.
Oh, she's just very slowly toasting toast.
Yeah. Slow roasted toast.
She's in a Tesco value toaster. She's going to take a while to burn, but it's coming.
I think we've used up all our rubbish toast analogies for now.
Yeah, I'm at the bottom of my list.
I always got the impression that she would, that the Tories would keep Theresa May in place to negotiate Brexit, that she would be a lightning rod for all the terrible things that are going to happen. And then they would dump her, they would get a new Prime Minister in, and they'll call an election and see how it goes. But then there's also talk of a caretaker Prime Minister, probably Phil Hammond, because he seems like the perfect kind of caretaker. We just need the most sensible guy in the room, who spent this week making jokes about Boris Johnson in Germany. Basically makes a joke about cakes, because Boris Johnson says that Brexit, you know, Britain can have his cake and eat it policy. And so Phil Hammond says about how ridiculous cakes are. The Spectator is absolutely mad that Phil Hammond could joke about Boris, when if Boris had done the same about Philip Hammond, they'd just go, oh, Boris. And so you've got some people who say that Philip Hammond will come in as Prime Minister in October, and then he'll negotiate Brexit, and then there'll be a new Tory leader, God knows who that will be, after Brexit's negotiated in March, we'll have an election. So we would have had 4 Tory prime ministers in 3 years. There could be a coup, but on the other hand, I can see her hobbling through for 2 years.
At the moment, I'm of the opinion that Theresa May's demise is going to come sooner rather than later. I'd be surprised if she makes it to the end of the year at this rate. You just cannot be the prime minister overseeing the most complex negotiations that the British government has overseen in its entire history, and being actively briefed against openly by allies and known allies of your Secretary of State, who's in charge of those negotiations. Now, that's not to say that James Chapman's quotes are being done on behalf of David Davis in any way. I'm sure he's sensible enough to know that that would not be beneficial for him or beneficial for anyone else.
But presumably he's also sensible enough to go to David Davis and say, by the way, I'm talking to the Times, I'm going to say this bunch of stuff. Is that all right?
Or sensible enough not to.
Yeah. You would not want to go to David Davis in that instance and say you've spoken to him about it, because you want him to have plausible deniability. And again, David Davis is also one of the people that's being talked up as a potential replacement for Theresa May.
Yeah, don't remind me.
Just always remember, it's double D for me, as his campaign was last time.
Oh, God, was it?
Yeah.
Did you not see that?
I've clearly scrubbed it from my mind.
Have you not seen the images of David Davis surrounded by young, God, attractive female Tories wearing pink t-shirts which say "It's double D for me"?
Somehow David Cameron just squeaked through.
I know. May's situation looks much more precarious with every single passing day. I think it's only a matter of time before something causes someone to actually pull out the knife and, you know, drive it into her back.
So I should call Michael Gove and see what he's doing this weekend.
Oh god,
there's this incoherency about the government, which feels more like a dog day second, third term government. The fact that on Wednesday we had people saying that the public sector pay cap would be lifted and then wouldn't be lifted, and then Tory MPs voted against that Queen's Speech motion for it not to be lifted. Again, that feels like they're walking straight into the kind of cheap political games that Labour used to fall into when George Osborne did them.
I think the Tories at the moment have got a massive issue in that they don't have a manifesto really they can fall back on. They don't have even an ideology to guide them, because the ideology for the past decade or so for them has been revolving around austerity, and it's becoming increasingly clear that that is not sustainable. Philip Hammond, even in their manifesto, basically removed the promises that said we are not going to put up taxes, because he knew at some point he would need to put up taxes in order to either fund something or cut the deficit further. May was beginning to outline a new ideology of a sort for the Conservatives, you know, much more state-centric, much more potentially authoritarian, but much less right-wing in some ways.
Very Ed Miliband.
Yeah, you know, involvement in the energy sector, backing, you know, getting workers on, sitting on boards and things like that. All stuff which, you know, the left wing of politics can get behind. That manifesto didn't win a majority, and there's nothing to replace it yet. So they're just stuck being reactionary rather than actually governing in a proactive manner.
It was actually a weirdly mixed bag, I'd argue. I was reading an article earlier today that argued that they lost because they were brutally honest about what it meant to vote Tory. And as well as your populist, more centrist policies about, you know, intervening in the energy market and so on, they had thrown in there literally taking away food from the mouths of hungry children and fuel from pensioners. Yeah, yep. Some very brutally honest, very more right-wing things in there, tossed in amongst the populace.
Yes, again, that
it's a really weird jumble.
You know, for lack of a better term, the May brand of conservatism, which, as I said, is kind of a cross between that more left-wing, working-class Erdington Toryism that Nick Timothy was pushing for, and, for lack of a better term, traditional kind of economic standpoints, kind of still essentially continuing with austerity in one form or another.
Well, the hilarious thing about the Tory DUP deal is that that deal commits the Tories to keeping the triple lock. It commits them to the winter fuel allowance. And there's a nice tweet from Grant Shapps, which may end up being one of the funniest things he ever said, which is that if they'd just kept this stuff in the Tory manifesto, they would now have a thumping majority and none of this would be happening.
Yeah.
And I think that's the crazy thing, is that they thought that they could be clever, and they were very, very complacent, and thought that they could just bash their main group of voters in their manifesto. Again, austerity, it's clearer now than ever that austerity is just a political choice rather than an economic necessity. And we assume in the autumn budget then some things will change, because otherwise the government will end up tanking more in popularity than it already is.
Yeah, I'm expecting actually to see the pay cap on public sector workers potentially go anyway under the Tories' terms. You can see actually in the response of a number of Conservative MPs by the likes of Heidi Allen and James Cleverley, who were basically defending their vote on Twitter by saying, one, the Queen's Speech Amendment was not a binding thing in any way. It doesn't change the law. And two, what the Labour Queen's Speech motion also would have done, and this is completely contradictory to the previous point, would have meant that, in principle, very well-paid senior civil service fat cats could also get pay rises. Given how things are going for the Tories currently and their desire to try and improve their standing somewhat, they're going to end up soften the pay cap in some way, and I suspect that will be via something very specific and very targeted. So it will be a pay increase for people under X amount. You know, something like people earning under, I don't know, 35k a year or something like that.
Don't worry, by the way, guys. Councillors have had a pay cut in the last few years. Hurrah!
Just about managing. So, let's talk about two amendments then for Queen's Speech that Labour brought in. One of them was by Stella Creasy, which guaranteed abortion rights for women in Northern Ireland. And with that and the payday loan amendment which passed, means that as a backbencher in 7 years, Stella Creasy's managed to get more public policy change than certain Labour backbenchers managed in 30, 35 years. But we'll just park that because, you know, we're part of the new United Labour Party. On that point, there was another amendment that Chuka Romana put through about the single market, wasn't there?
There was.
Saying that the single market is a jolly good thing and that maybe we should support it. And there was another Labour amendment, wasn't there, saying that not that we should be in the single market, but that we should keep all of the benefits of the single market. As Owen Jones would say, it's a more nuanced position. By nuanced, I assume he means rubbish.
Yeah.
Unachievable.
Yeah.
Mm.
Nuts.
Labour were whipped to abstain on the amendment, the Chuka Romana amendment. Yeah. I've never known anyone ever whip to abstain. I mean, that's quite impressive.
In a weird way, it is, yeah.
In Parliament, do you vote to abstain, or do you just simply not cast a vote?
I think you can abstain if you vote in
both.
Because
I've been in student politics debates that have gone on for several hours about the nuance of the difference between those two.
I think you can abstain by going into both the aye and no lobbies, so you can positively abstain, rather than just not turn up. I don't know if that's what people did.
That one's a gamble, though, isn't it? So you might not make it through the second one in time.
Like that scene in Titanic, where the door is closing, all the people working the furnaces are trying to get out. I don't think that's what the House of Commons is like, though. I've not seen PMQs for a while. About 100 MPs voted for this amendment, of which 49 were Labour MPs. Obviously, that is terrible, isn't it, Steve? Because Chuka Romana is not allowed to have principles.
No, apparently not at all.
But Jeremy Corbyn
is
allowed to have principles.
His 30 years of backbenching means he's allowed to have principles, but Chuka Romana, despite being a backbencher, is being criticised for putting in a position on principle. Mm. Which is, some might say, hypocritical. It's certainly an interesting argument to make, however you look at it.
And Jeremy Corbyn is allowed to triangulate, isn't he?
Yeah, and Tony Blair's was never. When Tony Blair triangulated in order to maximise electoral impact, that was the work of the devil, and he was selling out Labour's soul. When
well, because that got a majority of 179, whereas Corbyn's triangulation... Oh.
Yeah. Corbyn's triangulation over the most important issue of the day. I think there's a number of elements to this. Four front benchers from Corbyn's team voted for the Chuka Romana amendment. Those people have now been fired from the shadow cabinet. There's been a lot of criticism online for him firing those people. Actually, from my perspective, that's fine. If you're a member of the shadow cabinet, you buy into collective responsibility and you're supposed to go along with the whip. Given that it was whipped to abstain, they could have just not turned up, and that would have been fine. Instead, they actively went against the leadership, went against the whip. Doesn't matter what party you're on, what wing of a party you're on, that always results in you getting fired, and that's fine. The second issue I've got with this is that it already, 3.5 weeks away from the general election, Jeremy Corbyn has already started to take an action which has the potential to unravel his electoral coalition. A significant number of the votes that Jeremy Corbyn was able to attract to the Labour Party came from younger voters. Younger voters who are much more pro-EU. And here's the thing, by voting for a harder Brexit, by letting the Tories get away with a harder Brexit, and not taking the fight to the Tories on this issue. He's opening up a lifeline for the Greens and potentially the Lib Dems in some areas.
Let's not be silly.
Yeah, I know. Produce a load of videos online, target everybody who likes all the pro-Corbyn Facebook groups, all the people who like the Canary and all of those sorts of websites, and Squawkbox as well.
Don't think the young were that easily won over. I think they learnt their lesson with Brexit. You don't show up to vote, you don't get what you want.
But this is the thing. So many of them seem to... Corbyn's position during the election was very nuanced. It was on Brexit. It was put into me whatever you want to think. There was no kind of heavy outline about what we wanted to do. It was all, we want the benefits of single market access, but we don't want freedom of movement. Maintain strong working relations with the European Union, but also at the same time...
And the main one is tariff-free access to single market, which is a bit of a misnomer because most of the barriers to the single market are not tariffs.
No. I can easily see young people looking at Corbyn's actions and starting to go, well, hang on a second, on the most important issue of the day, something that we feel very strongly on, he's not actually gone with what we thought he was going to do. Now, granted, maybe some of that's just down to some quite well-played politicking on the part of Corbyn and his team. It's not something I thought I'd ever say. Speaking as a former Liberal Democrat, I can tell you...
You're asking, will this be his click moment?
Yeah. It could easily be the start of something like that, because when young people get pissed off with you, they get pissed off with you. And, you know, maybe in some instances with Clegg it was a delayed reaction. Eventually he was gotten rid of. The Liberal Democrats, despite, you know, having a new leader, despite having massive opportunities, have not recovered from it at all. If you're a man of principle, and that's your main selling point, is that you are a man of principle, and you are seen to have gone against a position that you've laid out, that's very dangerous.
I think Corbyn's will be a slower burner, though, if that is the route he's going down.
Yeah, I agree.
Mainly
I think it will be slow.
His vote doesn't immediately cost you 9k a year.
No, absolutely. I 100% agree. I don't think it's going to be a case of a crash and burn, but I do think this is laying the groundwork for, electorally, some problems for the Labour Party, because you need those younger people to turn out and vote Labour. If they turn out and vote Green, that doesn't help you. If they just don't turn out, and we did have increased turnout amongst young voters compared to last time, again, that doesn't help you. And given that they are such a crucial element of Corbyn's electoral coalition, that can cause some massive problems and potentially delivers the Tories a lifeline.
If I can play devil's advocate just for a second.
Is that why you put your horns on? You've got a remarkable array of dress-up stuff in this bunker.
It gets lonely.
I think it might be slightly different to the 9K thing. Because a Labour MP had themselves photographed with a sign that said, I pledge to stay in the single market. Also, I think a lot of people are looking at the fact that a lot of younger people who were pro-EU voted for Labour, forgetting that actually there's probably a lot of people who voted Leave in a lot of working class northern areas who voted Labour, precisely because the rhetoric from the party was not gung-ho soft Brexit. It was accepting the referendum result. It seemed like the decision to whip MPs to trigger for Article 50 looked bloody stupid 6 months ago. And actually, that position was borne out by events to be quite decent. Whether or not this one will be borne out by events as well, I'm not sure. I've just started reading Martin Pugh's book on the history of Labour, and it's quite interesting because some interesting parallels in the start of the Labour Party to where we are now because of the unusual position the party is because of Corbyn and Brexit. And then what Martin Pugh argues is that at the beginning in the 1900s, 1910s, Labour has to essentially fight lots of different regional campaigns because it has to adapt to very different working class cultures across the country. And so that's why Labour MPs had very different attitudes to temperance, say, in just the same way there were in the general election. So Welsh Labour fought a very specific Welsh-focused election that didn't mention Corbyn. People like Steve McCabe and Selyoak, hashtag stick with Steve, they focused very personal campaigns on local issues, didn't mention Corbyn, really didn't mention Brexit at all. 20 London MPs voting for this single market amendment. I think this is, again, a continuation of the fact that you've got Labour's now got lots of different electoral coalitions to come together. And this is one way for a group of Labour MPs to keep those coalitions together. The problem is, for a start, it would have been helpful if they hadn't have whipped the vote. I think that's a decision which is maybe not good and is maybe a sign that Corbyn's going to try and put a bit more discipline on the Labour Party than he did before. Because I think I'm right in saying that front benchers who'd voted to trigger Article 50 weren't sacked from the front bench.
Clive Lewis resigned.
He resigned, but I don't think he had to be sacked. So I think this is something new. I think the other problem is that we're also seeing why, although, as we've said before, Corbyn had a much better campaign than we thought, he's definitely shifted the Overton window on a lot of issues, and he's shown that someone from the left of the Labour Party can do a lot better electorally than anyone thought. I still think that Corbyn's part of the problem rather than the solution for Labour at the moment, because Corbyn's from the hard left of Labour. They've been anti-EU for 40 years. They're certainly anti-single market, because they think it means you can't get a lot of the far left stuff that they want to happen if you're part of the single market. So I think that's why they're making a much harder Brexit. If you had someone from the left of the party, like, say, Angela Rayner, actually as leader, I think that would really help, because it would be a way to try and prize off those soft Brexit Tories. The thing is, people like Nicky Morgan, people like Anna Sowerby, there is no point in breaking ranks at the moment and voting for single market stuff and voting for a softer Brexit, because they're isolated, they're out on their own with a rump of Labour MPs. If Labour had been whipped to back that single market motion, people like Nicky Morgan and Anna Sowerby could have voted for it. It could have passed.
Yeah, and I think that, for me, is the kind of the third and final issue I kind of take with the way that Corbyn and his team have kind of run this, is that they are the opposition they are supposed to oppose. And we have a very weak government. We have a government which is on its last legs. It is possible that they could have enacted and made a very clear sign that there is no majority in the House of Commons for a hard Brexit, which would be in line with polling. People support single market access. People support things like remaining in the customs union. They could have delivered a significant bloody nose to the Tories. They could have potentially shifted the government policy, which, you know, we joked earlier about how Stella Creasy had done more deliver policy changes than a lot of other Labour figures in recent history. That's what an opposition should be aiming to do, is, you know, affect policy as much as possible. Labour have just massively missed an opportunity to do that, which would have been electorally popular overall. Yeah, yes, there is some issues about the Labour electoral college consisting of people who are pro-EU and spit a load of people who voted Leave, but as we've just seen in the 2017 general election, they were quiet. They didn't go flocking to Tories. They didn't go flocking back to UKIP. They came back home. And I think, to be honest, as much of that is down to anti-Tory feeling as it is anything else. So as I don't think those people are necessarily at risk of being lost again at the moment. In comparison to that, the younger voters who are more pro-EU are much more likely to find a home elsewhere. I mean, I can see the logic behind what Corbyn and his team have done. I just think it's very much the wrong call on multiple fronts.
It shows a resurgent, more confident Corbyn, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely it does.
He's got enough people willing to join his shadow cabinet who can afford to sack some. That's new.
Yeah, especially as he's got a load of candidates who were elected this year who owe their jobs to him.
That's a definite dynamic shift. It's going to be interesting how that one plays out.
Yeah.
And if Jeremy Corbyn wants us in his shadow cabinet, he can find us on our Facebook page, which is new. It's facebook.com/notenoughchampagne.
Yep.
You can follow me on Twitter and Paperback Writer.
I'm at Centre Radical.
I'm at Bridget Jones.
Our logo is designed by James Cram. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. And our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper. We are back next week talking about Donald Trump.
Oh, God.